Picture the scene. It's Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark, in the early 1960s. Five architects are sitting around their office. Maybe they're looking at blueprints. Maybe they're discussing the latest American skyscraper. All of a sudden, a potential new client pops his head through the door.
And say, I have this big piece of land and I want to build something which is good for people. Not the usual crap.
Not the same old, one-bedroom flat, say, but something that's good for people.
And then we panic because everything architects do is good for people. And then we started to think, is it really good for people? And what is really good for people?
The guy speaking, that's Jan Geel.
I think that I will need a cup of coffee. I'd love a cup of coffee.
He was one of the five architects that day. And that question of his,
what is really good for people?
What did you go for? A latte?
Latte, yeah.
What is really good for people? Let's stick a pin in that.
Let's try the cappuccino.
Jan's been asking that question for 50 years. And it's the key to everything in this episode. It's also the key to everything we do at Space 10, where this podcast is produced.
Otherwise, it's very hot milk. There we go.
We're a future living lab based in Copenhagen, and we're on a mission to design a better and more sustainable way of life.
It's called Space-Time.
Space-10, T, like Space-T.
I'm James Klasper, and I can't tell you why I'm trying to speak Danish to help Jan understand what we're called. I guess I'm nervous because, well, he's a bit of a hero of mine. And here's why. In case you hadn't guessed, I'm not Danish, I'm English. But 3 years ago, my wife and I decided to leave England and move to Copenhagen. Why? Well, it wasn't for the Little Mermaid, the amusement park, or the beer, as lovely as they all are. It was for Copenhagen's quality of life. And as we'll see, Jan's fingerprints are all over that.
If you make a good city for those of 8 and those of 80, all the rest will be fine.
Welcome to Imagine, a podcast that explores the brave new world of shared living. I'm your host, James Klasper, and I'm the research lead at Space 10. This is the first of four episodes exploring how the way we design the spaces we inhabit can make us happier. In upcoming episodes, we're going to look at shared living and see if rethinking our housing models could help solve a number of global challenges, including rising urbanization, the increasing cost of housing, and social isolation. But first, we're going to explore how we can transform our quality of life by changing our cities. The story begins here in Copenhagen, and the hero is Jan Geel, of course. The villain? Well, there are many villains, but one is modernism.
The dominant school of thought.
The only school of thought.
At least it was back when Jan graduated from architecture school more than half a century ago.
I was trained as an architect in the 50s, and modernism was very much in at that time, and actually we were trained to be good modernists.
Modernism has been described as the single most important style or philosophy of architecture and design of the 20th century. The characteristics of modernist buildings include open plan floors and flat roofs, rectangular and cuboid shapes, and the use of steel or reinforced concrete. In other words, less is more.
I see a number of examples of this kind of thinking.
Picture modernist buildings today. Perhaps you see the Barbican Centre or the Heywood Gallery in London. Impressive buildings, sure. But you see, modernist architecture also resulted in social catastrophe, like the high-rise estates of St. Louis, Missouri, which in time were dynamited. By the time Jan Geel was at architecture school, modernism was becoming synonymous with entire cities, including Brazil's recently inaugurated capital, Brasilia.
That was the time they built Brasilia in Brazil, and three times a day we bent towards Brasilia. That was a great thing in city planning.
I'm amused by that image of the architects of the 1960s bending towards Brasilia. Designed by Oscar Niemeyer and Lúcio Costa, Brasilia was built in Brazil's heartland in just 3 years, using 1 million cubic meters of concrete and 100,000 metric tons of steel. It was distinguished by its modernist architecture, clean lines, zoned neighborhoods, and large amounts of space. Viewed from above, it looked like an aeroplane. But today, the city is seen as a failure and as a stark warning to urban planners. Brasilia's government buildings may be impressive, but thanks to its many highways, the city lacks walkable neighborhoods or interesting street life. Bureaucrats who live there have long raced back to Rio or Sao Paulo every Friday night. Poorer residents, meanwhile, have been banished to the fringes, resulting in vast urban sprawl. But back in 1960, when Jan was starting out, many people saw Brasilia as the city of the future. So it was somewhat surprising, to say the least, when a new client popped his head through the door and said he wanted to build something that was
good for people.
Needless to say, this got Jan thinking. Because, well, isn't everything architects do good for people?
Everything I was taught in School of Architecture was about the life inside the buildings. And it was always believed that by changing the inside of buildings, people could have a better life. And then we started to think maybe good for people is not inside the buildings, but also outside the buildings. So maybe good for people is very much what's happening between the buildings.
And this novel idea fell on fertile soil the moment Jan got home to his wife Ingrid, an environmental psychologist. Like most married couples, she and Jan often discussed their work, at the kitchen table, or whenever they got together with friends and colleagues from their respective fields. And as you might expect, their conversations got pretty intense, with Ingrid or one of her colleagues typically making the same point.
There are all these heated discussions where it's always ended with, why are you architects not interested in people? Why don't they teach you anything about people in School of Architecture?
In fact, Ingrid would goad Jan, asking him why his architecture professors would get up at 4 a.m. to take photos of buildings.
So there'll be no disturbing people in the foreground.
To ruin the shots. If there's a point of no return for the young Jan Gehl, this must have been it. Social scientists and architects, he realized, were living in two very different ivory towers. So, Jan and Ingrid, the architect and the psychologist, got funding to spend 6 months studying how people lived in Italian cities.
It was actually a scholarship from Carlsberg, and it was spent buying Chianti in Italian cities.
Sounds delightful, right? For half a year, Jan observed how people behaved in Italian cities. People wandering along Venice's canals, bustling down Perugia's crooked alleyways, or just hanging out in Siena's Piazza del Campo. Jan simply sat, possibly with a glass of wine in his hand, and watched people going about their lives, observing what they did, where they did it, when they did it, and for how long they did it. And in this way, he began to build a picture of how people used the city. I asked Jan to tell me what the most memorable part of his research was, and I was expecting him to say something like, "Oh, on such and such a day, I saw a man throw open the windows to his apartment and greet a woman reading a newspaper in the cafe below, while a busker began playing Vivaldi on the violin, drawing a large crowd of onlookers." He didn't say that. Instead, what he said was this.
Actually, there were no memorable examples, because everything we saw was there all the time and we did it ourselves every day.
You see, what Jan realized is that there's no mystery to how people go about their lives. In fact, how we behave is really quite predictable.
We do it, all of us, every day, but we don't think much about it. And only when you start to compress the knowledge and compress the documentation, then you start to see patterns, and the patterns are very, very obvious and very, very clear, and you can plan things based on these patterns so that they accommodate people much, much better than if you don't know these patterns.
In other words, cities may seem messy and chaotic, but there's order below the surface. It's what the legendary urban activist Jane Jacobs called organized complexity. Jan has a wonderful metaphor for the predictability of people's behavior in cities.
It's like the Laguna in Venice, where the tide sweeps in and the tides go out and the tide goes in. And the same thing with the city, it has its pattern. It wakes up in the morning and it builds up and then it builds down again.
Venice is unique in many ways, of course. But how people who live there go about their lives? Not so much. In fact, no matter where you go, people's behavior is pretty much the same. When Jan returned to Copenhagen, he observed people there too. And guess what? Danes are just as predictable as Italians.
That we could sit here and say, now it is September, it is 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's a fair day, good day. You can go down on the main street in that section, and then you will count, there will be 66 persons a minute passing that place. And you could go to that square and find out there will be 150 to 160 people sitting at 3 o'clock in this weather in September.
I know what you're thinking. Jan's an architect, right? Shouldn't he be looking at blueprints or sketching skyscrapers? Not sitting on a street corner and counting people like a train spotter. Yet there was method in his madness. In fact, he was on a mission. At the time, you see, two paradigms dominated urban planning.
Modernism and motorism in extreme forms.
Just as architects seemed to be building ever higher concrete blocks, so were urban planners paving the way, literally, for more and more cars.
Cars were streaming into our societies in the 50s. They started the invasion of cars.
Look at Brasilia, which one newspaper described as a city where the car is king and pedestrians regularly have to cross six-lane highways. Little wonder, then, that Jan doesn't like cars much.
We really have to address this idea that every man to be mobile shall carry a ton of steel and be provided with four rubber wheels to get anywhere. That is a very, very primitive technology. It's not necessarily something which will bring more happiness and more quality of life.
Of course, neither Brasilia nor Copenhagen was developed without a plan. And the best plans are usually based on facts.
Because the traffic engineers always have endless statistics about how the traffic was developing and how they could widen the streets to make ready for the future.
For Jan's human-centered design to prevail, he would need to beat the modernists at their own game.
Every city had a department for traffic engineering, transport, and no city in the world had a department for public life and pedestrians.
In effect, then, Jan became the department for public life and pedestrians.
We started to study how people use the city and started to get as many informations about the people who use the city as the traffic engineers were having about the cars who use the city.
By the early 1960s, Copenhagen had actually started an experiment in urban planning. It began by banning cars and pedestrianizing streets in the city's medieval center. Local shopkeepers were outraged, convinced that the experiment would harm business. In time, of course, they were proved wrong. In any case, as Copenhagen's city planners sought to turn the experiments into permanent features, they found an ally in Jan.
And this is here really introducing an ideology, a concern for subject which had been overlooked for a long, long time.
Together with colleagues at the School of Architecture at the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts, Jan was by now also treating the Danish capital as a kind of laboratory.
And I remember all the years where all my colleagues thought that I was on a wild goose chase and I was ruining my career possibilities in studying this funny thing about people when it's all about form.
With the city clamoring for stats about how people were actually using the streets, it turned to the pioneering professor. Finally, the happy marriage of Jan's research and Copenhagen's experiments took place.
And very shortly after we got this started, the city planners and the city politicians and the mayor running down to School of Architecture to say, what do you know by now? What shall we do next?
And they've lived happily ever after. Little by little, Copenhagen began to reclaim more of the streets for cyclists and pedestrians. If you've been to the Danish capital recently, you'll know exactly what I mean. The city now has more than 200 miles of cycle lanes, and it's very easy to walk around too. In this way, Copenhagen bears the hallmark of Jan's approach. In fact, when the city celebrated its 850th birthday in 2017, it named Jan as one of the 10 Danes who had indelibly shaped the city. For a sense of perspective, the list included Copenhagen's 12th century founder Bishop Absalon, the 17th century king Christian IV, and the 19th century industrialist Carl Jacobsen, who you may know as the founder of Carlsberg. And in a recent book about Jan's life and work, the former commissioner of the New York City Department of Transportation, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, wrote that if Jan Geel didn't already exist, it would be necessary to invent him in order to save our cities. Fortunately, he does exist. And around the world today, many cities have begun to turn their back on the car and are instead providing more space for cyclists and pedestrians. Every week, for example, Bogota closes 75 miles of roads to car traffic. Berlin, Hamburg, Madrid are all planning car-free zones. And Oslo is planning to go car-free by 2019.
There has been a change in the direction of the wind.
Indeed, we're starting to see a change in how we think about our cities and our quality of life. And every time a city adds a bike lane or makes its streets car-free, you can detect Jan's influence.
We can see it in all the cities which have been tidying up their streetscapes and doing much more for pedestrians and bicycles and public transportation and trying to curb the automobiles. Now, we talk about livability, we talk about sustainability, we talk about health, and we've started to talk about good cities for the aging.
And instead of thinking that economic growth, GDP, is the only way to measure progress, more and more people appear to be asking if our quality of life or well-being isn't a better yardstick. Just look at the rise of the surveys like Monocle's Most Livable Cities Index, which assesses cities based on criteria such as the quality of their architecture, public transport and urban design. What's more, from academia to policy-making circles to popular culture, there's increasing interest in well-being and in the importance of how we design our cities. Jan is as forthright as ever about the direction we need to go in. And here's a clue. It isn't by building shiny new cities.
I'll show a picture from Dubai and say, future of city is no Dubai. Not like Dubai at all. Dubai is modernism and motorism in extreme forms. And then I show a picture from Venice and say, the future for me is much more like Venice.
I love that idea of Venice as the city of the future. As Jan sees it, the ancient Italian port has exactly what it takes to make a city lively and attractive and interesting.
A city with very nice neighborhoods made very good at eye level and made for people of all generations who can be well served by a public transportation system.
In a way then, Jan's ideas about building cities for people and about life between buildings have never been more timely. They are, after all, universal ideas.
The way I have been advising cities and are doing city planning is very much based on the client, which in all places is Homo sapiens. We have all over the world the same biological history.
In other words, what all cities have in common are human beings.
Man is a social animal.
And at the heart of Jan's vision for appealing public space and the urban design that promotes it is what he calls the human scale.
We are a walking animal. We have the same senses. We can see equally long and hear equally little or much. And we can move with the same speed. And if we make cities which are close to the human body and the human behavior and the human movement systems, we will generally be on very safe ground.
We experience the city at eye level, usually at walking pace. So an interesting city, a livable city, is one that's designed on this human scale.
We only choose to go to the city if it offers interesting things for us. And the most interesting of all of them are the possibility to be with other people, could be the whole neighborhood, could be the whole world. Being in the presence of other people is highly interesting.
Here's the thing about cities. We're going to see a lot of them in the coming decades. And many of them are going to be huge. So-called megacities, home to at least 10 million residents. You see, just over half the planet lives in a city today. But by 2050, that figure will have soared to 68%. As the global population rises and people leave the countryside in search of better lives and jobs, our cities are only going to get bigger. In fact, the UN predicts that cities will swell by some 2.5 billion people by mid-century. Providing housing, jobs, transportation, energy, education and healthcare will be paramount. But it's imperative too that these cities are developed and designed to be as livable as possible. Which boils down to one fundamental observation.
Man is a social animal.
Indeed, if Jan's lifetime of work in cities teaches us anything, it's that there's something inherently human about wanting to be around other people, to see what other people are up to engage with them somehow, and that being in the presence of other people is highly interesting, and that we should build our cities accordingly, at the human scale.
So I think the smartest city is the social city.
That's another big fan of Jan Gehl.
My name is Mike Viking, and I'm the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen.
I know what you're thinking, but that really is a place. Mike and his team explore what makes some people happier than others. As he sees it, not only is the smartest city the social city, it's a city
where community can flourish, where a sense of trust can flourish, where we have soft spaces, where people can interact and create a sense of security, and where quality of life is free.
I don't know about you, but that sounds good to me. The question is, how do we get there? At Space 10, we're on a mission to design a better and more sustainable way of life. So in the next episode, we'll consider what a better life is, talk to Mike again about his latest research into well-being, and try to unpack that slippery word, happiness. Because only by understanding what actually makes us happy can we start to design a better world, a world that improves the lives of the many people. You've been listening to Imagine, a podcast exploring the brave new world of shared living. If you go to our website, space10.io, or to our page on Apple Podcasts, you can find show notes, including links to the topics we've discussed, and some further reading. We've also got a new publication out. It's called Imagine as well, and it's chock full of interviews and articles about this brave new world of shared living. So go check it out. This episode was produced by Space 10 in collaboration with Unsinkable Sam. The music is by Edvin Vickner. Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it.